Tonight's meeting is going to be a lot of fun. We have a documentary that was put together by a local filmmaker who actually happens to be with us tonight. Brandon, go ahead and stand up. Here's the guy who made this documentary. Now you can applaud. This is a DVD format. It's called Beyond Death's Door. This has a number of local experiences from Utah and Idaho that are portrayed by the actual people who experienced them. What we're going to do is run this documentary, and then when it's over, you can ask questions of Brandon or of me or whoever you want to ask questions of. Please ask a question of our filmmaker, Brandon, or whoever else on our board you'd like to direct one to, and I think you'll really enjoy this.
Even though death is as common as life, it still causes great anxiety for most of us. And although the majority of us will pass on peacefully surrounded by loved ones, death can come at any age, at any time. Whether by accident, health defect, or malicious intent, our passing can bring apprehension for us and excruciating grief to our loved ones. And although as Latter-day Saints we have a plan of happiness laid out before us, our transition from this world to the hereafter can still bring great trepidation.
In the 1970s, Dr. Raymond Moody published a book called Life After Life. And in that, Dr. Moody talked about the near-death experience that he had encountered as a medical doctor. As I read that book and found that there were so many parallels to our Latter-day Saint teachings concerning death and the spirit world, I became fascinated in how those experiences coordinate with Latter-day Saint doctrine. And so that was what really drove me to research and write about the phenomenon in the context of the Restored Gospel's teachings on death and the spirit world.
Brett Topp and his wife Wendy have taken a special interest in the study of the near-death experience. Over 30 years of exploration have culminated in an in-depth publication of their research.
One of the things that we found as we did this research on Raymond Moody's work on life after life and some of the experiences, even though they were not LDS, the descriptions they were giving certainly added a confirmation to our Latter-day Saint beliefs.
Since the publication of Life After Life in 1975, the near-death experience, a phrase coined by Dr. Moody himself, created a phenomenon that opened the door for others to openly share their own experiences beyond the veil.
I never intended to write a book. I'm not an author. I didn't intend to write a book. What happened to me was very personal. It was actually very sacred. I didn't want to share it with everyone and was actually concerned that maybe I shouldn't share it with everyone. And the significance of Mile Marker 80 is I actually went there to ask. It's like, is this really what I'm supposed to do? And I did. I went there alone and spent several hours and asked, is this what I'm meant to do? And I got a very profound answer. And the answer came back, and it was very, very distinctive. I mean, when that voice speaks to your heart, you get it. And I can quote what I was told. I was told, simply share your experience. And if you do, people will heal. And they'll get their own answers to whatever they're dealing with in their lives. We had just celebrated Easter. So we said all of our goodbyes, and interesting enough, my wife actually went back to the house to say goodbye one more time. Mom and Dad are on the porch waving goodbye, and she said, let me just go say goodbye one more time, and she ran up and hugged and actually kissed each of them, which I remember and am moved by it in hindsight. At the time, I thought, well, women, we already said goodbye. Let's get in the car and go. But anyway, northbound on I-15, we're driving up the road, and I've got all this stuff going on in my head about, okay, I'm a day late for work, I've got to get this taken care of, I've got to make these phone calls. And I happened to just look in the rearview mirror. And when I did, I noticed my youngest son, Griffin, who's just a toddler, and he was in his car seat. And suddenly all that chatter in my head just came right down, and I felt him. I saw him, and he was sound asleep. And I noticed, you know, like the way his hands set up on the car seat. I noticed how long his eyelashes were, and it just kind of hit me. And I then glanced at Spencer, my 7-year-old, which was sitting right behind me, and he was playing with Star Wars toys that he'd gotten in his Easter basket. And I felt him too. And then I noticed my wife, who had laid her seat back, and she was sound asleep. But yet she was still holding my hand. I just had this profound sense of gratitude, just this profound sense of thankfulness for everything I had. And of course, my attention, you know, got back on the road, and it was about an hour and a half beyond that. You know, there was reports of crosswinds. There was reports of a red pickup that was driving erratically. My biggest regret of the whole thing is that I think I fell asleep at the wheel. I think I dozed off just slightly. But it was enough that I veered right and overcorrected left, and then the car began to roll, not off the road, but down the road at 75 miles an hour on the cruise control. And they say, by the reports, it probably rolled no less than 8 times. It was a horrific accident.
When I was 25 years old, I lived in Washington. I was married. I had 2 children at the time. And there was a little boy who was abducted by a repeat sex offender who just brutalized him. And this little boy survived this attack. And I was watching this on the news and just appalled. And I called the station and was put in touch with just a handful of others that couldn't sit by and watch that kind of thing. And we got together and formed a couple of coalitions, one of which I was the president of, another one I was the vice president of, and we worked in tandem. We changed the laws governing violent sex offenders, but what started happening was all of these people with all of these horrific stories came to me. Instead of actually healing me, what it did is it just brought all this up like a boil, and I had memories then resurface. I just kind of went off the deep end myself. I started having this cyclical depression where I would just absolutely close off. I really believed that I was doomed to live my whole life this way and that my children were better without me. And there was one particular night was when I decided I was going to do it. And I took a bottle of a prescription, came up, and I also got in the bathtub and slit my wrists. And which I was really ineffective. I don't know how anybody's able to do that. And so I just kept taking medication for hours, just keeping it down. And then in the morning, I sent my children off to my neighbor's house with a note and just said, I'm not feeling well, will you watch them? And then I lay down on the couch.
This is Religion Today with Martin Tanner. A weekly look at religion and spirituality here at home and around the world. Now, here's your host, Martin Tanner.
Welcome. This is Religion Today. I'm your host, Martin Tanner. Today, our topic is near-death experiences, which I have been very fond of studying for years and years and years now, and I think tend to very much supplement and enhance our understanding of the gospel message.
Since his first experience reading Dr. Moody's book, Martin Tanner was drawn in to the near-death phenomenon. In 1989, he took part in the organization of the Utah chapter of IANS, the International Association for Near-Death Studies.
The National IANS was formed in 1981 so that people could have sort of a focal point to draw to when studying near-death experiences and assembling the mass of near-death experiences that had been drawn from at the time. Our local IANS group is similar to the national group. We really have a threefold purpose. The first one is to study near-death experiences. The second one is to have people share their experiences, which is useful for them. And the third purpose, which is huge, I think perhaps the most important one, is that people have a place to come where they can hear near-death experiences, and so
allay their own personal fears about an impending death if they have a terminal illness or if they've lost a loved one, a child, a parent, a sibling, a spouse. And those are, our main three purposes.
In our faith tradition, we often talk about spiritual experiences or visions or dreams. That's very common to us. But in the scientific community and psychology, social science, as well as the hard sciences, those are somewhat subjective terms. It becomes hard to interpret what a spiritual experience would be. And so in the 1970s and 1980s, there became a field of scientific study called the near-death experience phenomenon. And there's a broad cross-section of what that experience would be. Some people have that when they are near dying. Others have what might be called an out-of-body experience, which we may call a vision. Not all of them have all 14 characteristics. Some may have one or two. But there are certain things that are pretty common in what we would call an NDE or near-death experience.
The light is probably the central experience that most people report.
There are a number of different elements, but they can consist of things like having your spirit leave your physical body, usually upward. People then are often drawn to a light or through a tunnel to a light.
The light is the most wonderful thing that you can possibly conceive of. This light is so brilliant that it's brighter than the sun, and yet it is the most soft, welcoming, embracing light that you could possibly imagine.
We know from the scriptures and other teachings of the prophets that fire is used as a symbol of glory, and that light is used in the scriptures often to speak of the power of goodness and of God's power. Light permeates everything in God's realm or God's kingdom. When you think of the scriptures, that the glory of God is intelligence, or in other words, light and truth. And light is so important in coming to know God, and so it seems quite logical that light is God.
It coincides perfectly with Doctrine and Covenants section 88, where we're told that the light of Christ is in all things and through all things, and is the power by which they were made. That's probably the reason that everyone is born into the world with the light of Christ, is that we are literally composed of it.
Many of the near-death experiencers talk about cities that are of light, and even the beings are filled with light. I found a very interesting account where they spoke of the clothes or the robes that people wore as being made of light. I don't know exactly how to explain that, but when we think of fiber optics, when we think of a lot of the incredible advances in physics and communications in this day and age, almost always it deals with light in some way or another. One of the most common elements is that people feel this overwhelming love, and many of them speak of it as divine love, and that's how we would certainly characterize it. But it is just this all-encompassing love. It is permeating every fiber of your being, filled with the love of God. And I think that is clearly what the Apostle John is saying when he says that God is love, and that love is truly God's great attribute.
Interestingly enough, not in his formal 1838 account of his first vision, but in some of his other secondary accounts that he gave to other people, Joseph Smith described that when the light hit him during his first vision, that he experienced this overwhelming sense of love. And so it's very much the same kind of a phenomenon that the founder of our faith experienced.
The spirit world, of course, people report that it's, you know, the beauty is beyond description, that there's endless variety of everything, things to learn, things to do. People are happy, people are learning, libraries, everything that we have here that is good, you would find there, only multiplied, you know, to the nth degree.
They describe a place of peace, sometimes flowers, nature, waterfalls, beautiful buildings, amazing cities.
People have reported the buildings are made of light, the flowers are made of light, that there are beautiful, there's beautiful music playing with intricate musical patterns and things that you would never be able to produce on Earth. There are beautiful smells, fragrances.
President Jedediah Grant, who served as a counselor to President Brigham Young with Heber C. Kimball as the other counselor, died at a very young age. And shortly before he passed away, he had what we today would call near-death experiences. And one of the things, in addition to the incredible beauty of the plants and the flowers, the incredible feelings of peace and comfort and ease that he felt, and the dread of having to go back into his body, he also spoke of the incredible order that was there. And he said that there was no disorder among any of the spirits that he could see, and that they were organized after families. Now, he didn't elaborate on what that meant, but I did find it fascinating. And then we find other accounts where, at least among what we might call the righteous, that it was very, very orderly. To me, one of the great patterns of order and the spirit of harmony and usefulness and service that prevails in the spirit world would also be how things function in the temple. I think you see the order, the organization of the temple as a perfect type and model of God's kingdom. The scriptures speak of God's house as being a house of order. We know there was order before we came to earth in God's house. We know that there's order in God's kingdom on earth. Clearly, there is a lot of order, organization, and usefulness in God's kingdom after this life.
I am from a very large family. There are 10 children in my family, and I'm from a very small town in Idaho. It was the summer after my 11th birthday, so I was still pretty young, and I don't think I really realized the implications of what happened until I was much older. So we had just been playing baseball, and just by accident, I was hit in the head with a bat, and that was the last thing that I remember before my spirit left my body. And it felt, I don't remember the actual movement of it. I just knew that I was in my body one moment and out of it the next. Right away, I noticed that there was somebody by me as well, who was a little bit above me. And as I kind of noticed, I kind of just noticed the lower part of me. We both had a light that seemed to come from our core. I could feel a lot of wisdom in that person, and there was just such an immense feeling of safety. And I think that's probably the biggest thing that I take from that experience. Really, it just was like if you could take every positive emotion or experience that you could have, just anything that feels hopeful and safe, it's almost like that was what the atmosphere was composed of. And it felt like in that state of being, I could have been happy forever. Like, it was just a very, very peaceful, very warm and infinite love. It was just this incredible amount of love. The odd thing is, I remember looking at myself, and it was on the other side of me, so it was like I could see kind of all of myself at once. Like, I don't really know, like, perception is just different. Like, it's very different there. You don't see things in the same plane as you would here, I guess. The experience was very brief, but very powerful. And immediately I was back into my body. I remember being led up the stairs, and my dad was calling the hospital to tell them we were on our way. One of the things that I took from this experience that really impacted me was knowing that my spirit self is my true self. I feel really blessed to have had the opportunity to kind of revisit that spirit self and to see myself as I was, and not even as I was premortally, but as I really am, as my spirit really is. It's nice and humbling to know that we have that piece of celestiality within ourselves, and that we can bring that to a telestial world, and we can help people because of the spirits that we have. And everybody has that. It's within every single person. I feel really lucky that I got to experience that.
At the scene of the accident, I knew it was serious. I didn't know how seriously I was injured, because my first conscious recollection was I could hear my oldest son, Spencer, crying in the back seat. So I knew he was okay. And I wanted to get to him, but then I realized I couldn't move. Both my legs were crushed. My back had been cracked in two places. My rib cage was crushed and collapsing. My right arm had almost been torn off. I was unaware of all that. All I knew is I wanted to get to my son because he was crying. But that's when it hit me that no one else was crying. I couldn't hear the baby. And in that instant, I realized half my family's gone. My wife and child are past. They're gone. But the regret and the guilt and the anguish and the bereavement of, oh my gosh, my family, what am I going to do? And am I at fault? I was driving the car. But what happened at the scene of the accident, when I had this calm come over me and I began to rise above the scene of the wreck, I seemed to be surrounded by light. I felt this light around me. And it was almost tangible, like it was infused with love, like I was being embraced, and yet it was by nothing tangible. It was just light. It was just energy. I felt so much love in such a hellish situation, and here was all this light surrounding me. And that's when finally I realized, gosh, I'm here with my wife who was gone, but we're here and we're fine. I'm fine. The interesting thing in that light and that love is there was such knowing, it was such knowing. When she's saying, you've got to go back, you can't stay, it's like I knew that. I knew I was to be with my son, even though I was saying goodbye to the woman I loved more than life. And there was a familiarity. I mean, it was home. I knew I'm home. It was so real, and this is the crazy, foggy dream now. Having experienced that, it was almost like stepping through a veil into reality. And that was real, and this is not. For whatever reason, as I made that transition and finally found myself wandering through a hospital, you know, and I had no sense of time. I mean, I later found out people had arrived at the scene. We were rushed to Cedar City. They could do nothing for me there, so life flighted me. But as I found myself wandering through the hospital and seeing all these people, everyone I saw, I knew them. I knew everything about them. I knew their love, their hate, their choices. I loved them. I loved them absolutely unconditionally. We were equal. We were one. I mean, I felt God's love for them. And in fact, I was experiencing it. I wasn't just knowing it or feeling it. I was experiencing how loved every individual was and how important they were and how important their life was and how their choices. The perceptions expanded to where I thought, oh, I see the choice they made. I see what happened there. In that weird perception where, like, time just folds and goes away, I knew it was perfect for them. It's like, well, that's exactly what they came here to learn. So I love them for their courage in simply coming here to do this. That person's path looks far different than this person's path, and yet that was okay. And I felt God's love. In fact, I felt His absolute grace in saying, you get to go have your experience, and you get to have choice in all of that. I had a profound question that really didn't come from within me. It came from without of me. But the question was, to what degree have you learned to love?
Now, we know that we were spirits before we came to this earth, and that our immortal spirit is housed in an earthly tabernacle, and when it is released from the earthly tabernacle at death, that immortal spirit carries with it incredible capacities. And one of those that I found extremely interesting was in the area of communication. As we were doing the research for the book, we came across many accounts where they talked about not speaking with their mouth like I'm speaking right now, that it's not auditory nerve in our ear, it's not the brain that's computing it, that they were speaking directly to the mind.
Most people have a sense that they're communicating or talking, but if you ask them, were you really talking? Was this in words? They'll think about it and say, no, it was more like thought to thought. There's no room for error. There's no misunderstanding like with human speech. These people were communicating directly via thought with deity or their family members or whoever they encountered.
Now, before we think that's too strange, that's exactly what the scriptures speak of as the spirit of revelation. Orson Pratt was probably one of the greatest LDS theologians and philosophers, and of course an apostle and sustained as a prophet, seer, and revelator in his own right, taught that it is the spirit of revelation by which spirits communicate, and that the spirit speaks to the spirit, or we would say the heart and mind, as if there was no body present. That is remarkable when you think about it, that some of the great communication that we've received in mortality has come to us not through the ears and not even necessarily through the brain, but directly to our spirit. That's an incredible capacity. Another capacity of the spirit world that is just amazing to me, and that we discovered in our research, many people talked about how they felt like they just had knowledge being infused into their soul. And I found that fascinating, that they were learning, because in Latter-day Saint literature of spirit world, the prophets have talked about that when we are free from the physical body, that we will learn 100 times faster than we do in mortality. And Parley P. Pratt said that we will retain that knowledge. Now that, as I get older, that's pretty darn important, because I can't even remember where I parked my car. Elder Pratt also made a very interesting statement that in the spirit world, it is not like we are just learning with 5 senses. He says we are learning as if we had 50 senses, that we are absorbing information and the knowledge and glory of God, and much of that comes instantaneously to us through faith and righteousness.
Talk to a man who had just the most bare bones of formal education. He had not quite finished grade school, as a matter of fact, and that was all the formal education that he had. And he had fallen off from a motorcycle and had quite a dramatic accident. And he had this near-death experience where he was drawn off from the earth, and he believed that he was standing there with Jesus and was able to ask all kinds of questions that he had never had a chance to study. Some of those were the age of the earth and the purposes of the earth and the future and about science and all kinds of things. And he said that he learned all kinds of details about mathematics and astronomy, and was unable to bring all that back because somehow that would have thwarted some of the purposes of his own life that he had chosen before he came here. But he nonetheless believed that on the other side, learning is something that is very easy. We can gain vast amounts of knowledge in a very, very short period of time on the other side.
Growing up, I've struggled with low self-esteem. I've struggled with my self-image, confidence, all those kind of things. Home life was pretty rough. I developed some addictions pretty early on. I got into drugs when I was about 14 years old, just to cope and deal with the stresses I was feeling in life. When this happened to me, I was living at home with my parents. I'd been home from my mission for 3 years. It was late. I was really struggling with just moving forward in life. I felt like I was completely stuck. I was spinning my wheels and I wasn't getting anywhere. I went downstairs and my sister's purse was out and a bunch of the pain meds were there. I took a couple, went to sleep. I was feeling pretty good. Woke up a few hours later. I was wide awake. I thought they had worn off. Took a couple more, went back to sleep. Woke up a few hours later. I thought they had worn off. And then I took a couple more and I was like, you know, if I don't wake up, I don't really care. When my mom found me, she found me, it was about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. She heard some weird noises coming from my room. She was hearing a squeaking noise. And so she went into the room and turned on the lights and I was there. My face was blue, my lips were purple. I was breathing about once every 20 seconds, just barely breathing. Anyhow, she got an ambulance over there pretty quick. I remember not being connected to my body, like the connection between me and my body was really weak. I felt like, I don't know how to explain it. I felt it before, but it was like this perfect stillness. Everything, every kind of tie, every kind of emotional stress or physical stress or spiritual stress, everything was just, it was gone. There was that perfect stillness. A year before this experience, I had a very spiritual dream. There's dreams that are nonsense, but there are dreams where you feel the presence of the Spirit and you know it's an important message. In this dream, I died, and I showed up to my own funeral. My family was there. Everybody I knew and loved was there. And that same feeling that I had a year later was there. That perfect stillness, the white, that complete relief. I didn't have any worries. I wasn't worried. I just remember yelling. And I'm like, can't you hear me? I need somebody to hear me. I love you guys. I want you to know that I love you. That was pretty much the dream. But I feel that dream was very significant because it showed me what was going to happen if I really did pass on with that experience a year later. I had an uncle that died when he was 17, and I feel that he brought my mom to me because she was getting ready to leave. My uncle Nathan brought her there to make sure I didn't pass on, to make sure I stayed. I was aware of what was going on when my body was being jumbled around, when I was being put onto the stretcher, all the noises, all the people. I felt, but I didn't feel. With my spirit connected to my body, I was like hyper aware of everything. Intensely aware of all the colors, the lights, the sounds, the people. It was like I could perceive everything at once. I could understand everything at the same time, and then I'd be kicked out of my body again, and then sucked back in, and then kicked out again, and sucked back in. But as a result of this experience, I'm not going to relate what I learned when I was out, but when I was firmly back in. I've heard people say life is fragile. I didn't know it was. I didn't know how much help from the other side there is with us from day to day, every single day. And as far as my Savior and my Heavenly Father, how I feel about them now and what I know about them now, they're close. They hear me. I know that Jesus Christ, I know He's here. He can be with us every second of our lives if we want Him and need Him to be.
Another one of the core elements of the near-death experience that has been characterized by the leading scholars on the subject is that of some form of life review. We hear the phrase a lot, my life passed before my eyes. We don't know exactly how that works, but so many experiencers, both Latter-day Saint and non-Latter-day Saint, religious, unbelievers, speak of some kind of a review. I think it's important that we mention that it is not a final judgment. It is not a final review.
I've never interviewed a kid younger than the age of 8 who's had a life's review as part of their near-death experience. Most adults who have any kind of a lengthy near-death experience will have a life review as part of it.
Some speak of it of in an instant. All of the experiences of their life are seen and experienced and observed. Others speak of it almost like movie scenes that they experience or a photo album that they're reviewing. In the scriptures, when it speaks of a judgment where it says that our sins will condemn us, Alma speaks of our thoughts condemning us, our words condemning us, our actions condemning us. And he said we would be glad to have the mountains fall down and cover us up. It's one thing to see all of my dumb things, but then to be made to feel everything that my insensitive, unrighteous, irresponsible actions, attitudes, words, thoughts caused other people to feel. To me, that's why I repent, is so that not only can I be forgiven of my sins, but that I can become a new creature, and that my life review will be the new Brent Top, not the old Brent Top.
All of a sudden, I felt this incredible, intense energy, like a vibration, and this very, very loud whirring noise at the same time. I had the experience like I was laying down in the belly of a jet while it was taking off, or that, you know, possibly there was an F-15 coming down in the backyard. It was that loud and that intense. And then I went directly into what's called the life review, where I went through every single moment of my life, just in quick succession. Some of it was very detailed. A birthday party in particular was very, very detailed. Some of it I breezed through, like it was not as significant or as important. There wasn't as much to experience or learn from it. But all of it I was watching before me on a screen and experiencing it like multidimensionally as well. And then I came all the way to the end, to the point where I am laying on the couch and it stops abruptly. And then there's darkness. And at that moment, I become aware to a presence beside me. I know that he's male. I know that I know him intimately, like powerfully. And I know that he loves me. And I hear, this is your life. This is the life you lived. And I'm looking around. I swing my head around. I'm looking for my uncle who died in a car accident when I was about 11, a cousin who died when she was a child, my grandmother, and there's nobody there. I'm just surrounded by this darkness. But it's a palpable darkness. It's not just the absence of light. It's like a mist-like darkness that's comprised of molecules. I swing my head to the right, and on my right are about 6 teenagers. I say, oh, we must be the suicides. And that's when I realized that my thoughts were actually audible, because I thought it, but it was out there. Because the kid standing right next to me turns and looks at me and then looks away. But the minute I have the thought, oh, we must be the suicides, that propels me into the next experience. And all of a sudden, I am taken from them and I'm flying through this darkness in an upright position for I don't know how far. It could have been the length of a football field. It could have been the span of the earth. I have no idea. I do know that I was on the earth somewhere. And I do know that I was traveling very, very fast.
One of the other unusual elements of near-death experiences is that people seem to be able to think and they travel accordingly. One of the earliest books that described that was George Ritchie's Return from Tomorrow. I felt privileged to know him and to talk to him about it specifically and ask him if that description in his book was really accurate. And he said, yes, it is. And in hundreds of people who I've interviewed since then, they all describe the same kind of a thing. Rather than the cumbersome mode of travel that we have here, when you are, in essence, just a spirit. You can think where you want to go, and you can travel there almost instantaneously.
Brigham Young talked an awful lot about that when we are free from the coarser elements of this earthly body, that we can travel almost at the speed of thought. He said, you can travel to China. You can travel to any place in the world. All you have to do is think and you are there. Brigham also said, if you want to go back to see the Garden of Eden the way that it was created, all you have to do is think and you are there. And so he's speaking of this incredible capacity of travel faster than the speed of sound, faster than the speed of light, perhaps. I don't know how it works, but he also says that we can travel back and see things as they were created spiritually, for spiritually they remain, and we can travel to that. And how that works, I don't know.
Another very fascinating, because I can't quite explain it because I have not had near-death experience myself, is their concept of time. They frequently come back from their experiences and say, time's different. Well, how's it different? Well, it's just really different. Well, how long did your near-death experience take? Well, I could say it took 5 minutes or 5 years, and it wouldn't make any difference, because neither one of them would be quite accurate, because time is just somehow different there.
As long as I can remember, I've had a great interest in where we've come from before birth and where we go when we die.
With a career as a seminary and institute instructor in the church education system and a passion for church history, Paul Smith also spent his time researching near-death experiences. He has personally met with dozens of experiencers to hear their extraordinary first-hand account.
Our ward was blessed with two very unique young women. Wendy Jean Partridge was born in 1978, suffering from cystic fibrosis. Jessica Rosa Hunt was born in 1987. She suffered from cerebral palsy. Both girls died within 3 months of one another, and I had the opportunity of speaking at the funeral of both of them. Both girls were good friends of mine. Both had been beyond the veil, and both of them shared stories with me of experiences that they had. For example, Jessica said that her mother had given birth to 10 children, and most of them died prematurely. And yet she gave names to each one of them. When Jessica was on the other side, she played with each one of them. Each one went by the name they were given by their mother, and each had a love for their mother and the desire for her to raise each one of them when the millennium came. Wendy Jean had some significant experiences, and I would like to read in Wendy's own words of one of those experiences. I was shown the majesty and depth of God's love for us. I was shown things pertaining to who I was and my mission on earth. We were so happy to have the opportunity to become like our Father in heaven. I felt His immense love for us and understood how much He wants us to succeed. My eyes were opened concerning the atonement. I comprehended it as I had never had before. Both young women had total and absolute love for others. I am so grateful to have known both of them. My life is enriched. My life has changed because of Jessica and Wendy.
I see this beltway in front of me, and I see thousands and thousands of people along this beltway off to the left, and everybody is off to my left. And the first thing I notice is they're all wearing robes, white robes, but they're dirty, they're filthy, that they're all very disconnected, that they're not talking to each other, they're not related to each other, they're not interested in each other, but they're all kind of talking and bemoaning. There was one woman in particular who was just carrying on and loud and saying, if only you had done this or done that. And then there was a man that was kneeling in front of me, off to the left. And he noticed me, and he was looking at me. And what I noticed immediately was that I was seeing in grayscale. I wasn't seeing in color. I was seeing with my eyes, but I knew things. Like, I knew his eyes were blue. I knew he'd been there about 2,000 years. I knew he'd killed himself. And I had the thought, I wonder if this is Judas Iscariot. And that thought is evidence that I believe in a Christ. All of a sudden, I see a pinpoint of light in the distance at the same time that I hear the words, is this what you really want? But it's not just words. It's like booming, like thunder, like rattling the universe, but not loud. And I see this light approaching me, and all of this darkness, everything around me, all of the molecules around me start vibrating, like reverberating. This is God, this is God, this is God, this is God, as he's approaching. And he stops some distance from me because I know he can't come in where I am. And his robes are white and he is made of light. And his hair is flowing and I know that this is my maker. And it had never occurred to me that this was something I wanted. I felt like I had no choice in the matter. And I said, but my life is so hard. And he says, you think it's hard now? And he didn't have to complete, it's like the communication is like I get the whole world of it in like two words that aren't even spoken. It's just all telepathic communication. He says, you think it's hard now? And the rest of that was, it's nothing compared to what awaits you if you take your life. And then he says, you cannot skip over parts. It's supposed to be hard. We've all done it. And then I heard another voice, and it was the same voice that came from the man that was next to me during my life review, who I couldn't see. And he says, don't you understand? I did this for you. And at the same time, I was taken to the Garden of Gethsemane. And I was experiencing as if I was in Christ's body in the garden while he was suffering for me. It was very personal. It was my life from the beginning, that moment that I was born, to when I was laying there on the couch, like every single moment of my life, as if it was his. And then it was shown what would happen to my children, my two little boys. And when I saw that, I just had the tiniest little smidge of an okay. And that was it. And just, I was up and out of there. And there were angels just all around me. And I asked, what is this? And I was told, well, they're helping you, and they always have been. And I was told all kinds of things about just the nature of life. What I needed to know, it was like I was packed this suitcase of information. And it was so much that I can't even express it all. So I traveled through this darkness until I was back into my body. And as I opened my eyes, I could immediately feel the effects of the drugs. Now I could hardly move my limbs. When I swung my legs down off the couch and sat up, and I looked around the room, and at the same time, the front door was swinging open. My husband, he was coming in the door, and the sun was just filling the room, and I'm noticing all these things around the room that I can see. The plants are made of light. The couch, the organization of the molecules, and I can see them vibrating. We are couch, organized matter. We are couch, serving you, serving God. We are pillow, serving you, serving God. We are floor, serving you, serving God. Like, I could see all of this. But my husband sits down, and I just say, you're never going to believe this. And he goes, I think I just might.
The most profound experience I probably had was at the end of my hospital stay. I had had all my surgeries. They would do a surgery and let me get a little more healthy and then do another one. And I was actually in the rehabilitation center. I was out of ICU. I was out of surgical recovery. I was in the rehab wing. I was off of all the heavy medications. I was simply taking some Tylenol. They had repaired my shoulder. I had this profound dream. And I call it a dream because I don't know what to put on it. I went soundly to sleep one night. And during that sleep, I had this dream where I found myself in that place, in that light, in that familiarity that was home. I knew it was home. That's the best word I can come up with, is I was back home. And I was moving about freely. I was perfectly fine. None of the injuries were there. And it was a big deal for me in this dream because I'd been a Division I athlete and I was crippled for life. And yet in this dream, I'm moving about with no pain. Everything's great. Both legs are there. And as I'm going about just elated that I'm home, I came onto a corridor. And intuitively, I knew I was to go down that corridor. And so I did. And it was this beautiful structure. And I remember there was no windows in it. There was openings, but there was no glass panes. And that was one weird little detail. But I moved down the corridor. And at the end of the corridor was a crib. I rushed to the crib. And laying in the crib was my little boy. There was Griffin, sleeping as peacefully as he was when I'd seen him in the rearview mirror in the car. I mean, as a father, I just swept him up and held him. I held him and he was solid, he was tangible. I could feel his little body, I could feel his breaths, you know, expanding, I could feel the heat. But I was feeling at a level that I've never felt before. I felt every bit of light and life in every one of his cells, and it was melding into me, and he was firm against my chest. In fact, I laid my head on, I laid my face on his head and felt as I had in life, but I was feeling it at even a more extreme level. And I just thought, I'm here with my little boy. I'm here with my son. I sensed it was temporary, but I was just joyful that here I am as I held him, feeling all this and knowing all this and just relishing the fact that I got to hold him one more time. I felt someone come up behind me. And what I felt was so overwhelming. I mean, this person was so wise and so powerful and so all-knowing and yet was so personal and so loving. And I didn't even dare turn around. I was so overwhelmed with what I felt. And I knew I was standing in the presence of God, and I was standing there holding my son, so thankful that I was experiencing this. And as I held him, my divine creator came and held me. And we all just like melded into each other, and it's like everything vanished, and all of a sudden I had this download of everything. I saw my whole life. I saw my childhood. I saw my parents' divorce. I saw all the things that had challenged me. I saw the wreck. I saw all that happened there. I saw the choices I had made. I saw the things I did that were wrong. I saw the things I did that were wrong, and I knew they were wrong, and I did them anyway. And yet, in all this love, and again, it was this unconditional love, there was no judgment. I mean, I was in the arms of God, and He was saying, look how I love you. Look how your life has served you. Look what we created. In fact, I became very aware that I had created it, that I had literally taken part in some of the things that would take place. Even some of the choices I made were simply there to serve me and my soul's growth. And I learned a lot about choice in that event too. I mean, it hit me that everything's a choice. I have a choice in everything. I may not get to control what happens, but I always can choose how I experience it. And even though nothing was being said, this was just a download of knowledge, I was given a choice there. In fact, what was communicated to me is you can be a victim and feel like your family was torn away from you, or I'm giving you the chance to literally give them to me. You can give your wife and son to me, and no one will ever take them away from you again, because you get to exercise your will. And in all that peace and beauty and love and light, I was actually able to kiss my little boy goodbye and put him back in the crib. And then I woke up in my hospital bed. Back to the pain, back to the bereavement, but I had a different insight.
Perhaps the most important element of near-death experiences that people bring up over and over and over again is that the biggest purpose of life is love, and to learn to love unconditionally and completely, and to have caring and compassion for everyone.
The experience has made me really want to convey love to other people and to do more service for people and to really be kind whenever the occasion permits to be kind.
Christ has a pure love for all people, and so I treat people differently now. I let go of my judgments and my criticisms, and I try and see him how he sees me.
When we remove the veil, you know, our blindness, and we can see each other, all there is to do is to love and be kind.
When Christ was approached about the greatest commandments, it was love God and love your fellow man.
Because we are ruled with love, God has given us agency to choose him or not to choose him. Because of love, he would never force anything on us. He couldn't.
I kind of like this quote that Emanuel Swedenborg, who was a religious leader in Sweden about 100 years before Joseph Smith, the way he described it. He said, "We are here on earth, suspended between heaven and hell, and influenced by both, so that we can freely choose between the two."
We need to recognize, just like the law of restoration, that what goes around comes around, that the good that we do comes back to us. It's not that we have to wait till the spirit world or the resurrection to experience that it actually blesses our lives right here and now.
Service is really the balm of Gilead. Find a way to do something for somebody else, and then go find another.
Those who have been beyond the veil come to treasure life far better than before.
I've come to realize that all I have is right now, and it's a gift. I mean, the past is gone. There's nothing we can do about that except learn from our experience. And the future, there's no promise of tomorrow. Everything went away just like that. I mean, in a split second in a car, and half the family's gone, I'm maimed for life, and everything changes. So all we really have is the moment, and now I approach life in that moment. And I get to make a choice in every moment about how I'm going to experience my life, even if something comes up that's challenging or that doesn't feel good or that is emotionally trying. I still get to choose in that moment, what am I learning from this? How am I growing from this?
For those who are contemplating suicide or who deal with depression, what you experience, you take with you, and then it's intensified. It's not the answer. You don't find solace.
In my out-of-body experiences or dreams or visions or whatever you want to call them, I actually got to say goodbye to my wife and goodbye to my son, and I know a lot of people that don't get that. Gosh, say I love you. Write the letter. Send the email. Give the hug. Don't leave anything undone because you may not have the chance tomorrow.
Orson Pratt, in one of his talks, said to the saints who gathered in the tabernacle, he said, "You may wonder why I speak so much about the spirit world. Is number one, so that we have hope and that we can look forward to those coming joys, that sometimes when life is difficult and challenging for us, we need to remember that endure in faith to the end, because the Lord is going to make up all of our losses, and it will be a glorious resurrection and glorious return to our Heavenly Father." I think it's so exciting and inspiring to think of what awaits us, that death need not be feared.
When George Ritchie wrote his Return from Tomorrow book, was he described being drawn to a place when he was in the presence of Jesus and seeing far away in the distance. And he said this was before he'd ever read the book of Revelation. And he saw this beautiful, golden, bright city. And he could see people there. And they were bright and glorious and incredibly brilliant and knowledgeable, just like Jesus. And he describes in his book, and he described to me in person, how it had never before crossed his mind that people could all become just like Jesus, if they focused their life on him and tried to be like him, they literally could do that. Very much like the famous couplet is, as man is now God once was, as God is now man may be. And that's a truism that people who were not LDS have observed personally in near-death experiences.
In realizing who I was, I finally realized the message of the Christ, of Jesus. I mean, he came and said, look, I'm the Son of God, and so are you and you and you and you and you. Walk on the water, Peter. Why do you doubt? Greater things will you do than this. I realized, gosh, Jesus didn't come to show us how wonderful he was. He literally came as a mirror to show us what we are and can become and be. Even now, I mean, even on the mount, you know, be ye therefore perfect wasn't a confusing command at all. He was literally saying, be it, embrace it, remember who you are and remember that connection to deity, and that's the key.
We hope you enjoyed that. If you are interested in a copy of the DVD, Brandon Smith has brought a number of those. Brandon, come on down here. Anybody have any questions? Any questions?
Brandon, how did you find the people that you interviewed? Were there any kind of miraculous connections there?
Martin was one of the first ones that I contacted through IANS. He was really instrumental in helping me get connected to people like Jeff and Angie, and then Brent Topp was also a producer on the film, and so I think he had personal connections with the other two of the short story. Did Chris come? Is Chris here? Chris was going to come. Chris and Cammie. What's interesting is you could have grabbed a handful of anybody that's had experiences and had just as fascinating stories and insights, and this is just such a sliver of what studying near-death experiences can give you.
That was pretty magnificent what you've done.
Thanks.
I think that pretty much sums up the whole thing. The LDS thing, plus those who don't know about that, can get a feel for how incredible this whole thing is. How long did it take you to put that all together and to have what we have today?
It took about a year of work. I made it with a company called Covenant Communications, and they're a subsidy of Deseret Book. As you notice, it's intended or geared for an LDS audience, but my hope is that it doesn't. Anybody who watches it hopefully could also get the feel of what studying near-death experiences can do, or coming to these meetings. So that was my hope in creating it. Yeah, it was about a year.
Terrific job. And one thing I've always wanted to do when I come to these things is tell these guys that are putting this together and going to all the work, you know, and getting the speakers, guys like you, thank you. Because I've been coming to this thing for I don't know how many years, and you don't know how this has influenced me, and I'm sure that there are a lot of people here who feel the same way. This is really the highlight of my month. I come here and I have a great time. So thanks.
I enjoyed this so much. I think it really is a wonderful way to do a little bit of missionary work, since I am LDS. And I did feel there was a lot of scriptures in there that matches up with people that are not LDS, so they're going to relate. I'm for sure going to take it to my sister, who was LDS, and then later in life she changed and went to another church with her husband, and they lost a baby. And I love that part where you were showing that the babies died, and the mother got to see the babies playing and everything, and her little baby was like probably like a pound, and it was a little boy. And I think that she's really going to pick out parts of this movie that's going to relate to her. So I think it's a good audience out there and in here, both.
Thank you.
And let's see, I also want to know how long this has been on the market. And it's in the LDS bookstore now, right?
It is, yeah.
Because I think that I bought this, what, a couple of years ago?
Yeah, it's about 3 years old now, I think.
And, well, I just want to make sure so that when I buy more that I want to give to people for Christmas, that I know how many to get. Thank you so much for sharing.
Thank you.
My son was on a mission in California when I read the book, Return from Tomorrow, and he told me that George Ritchie had converted to the LDS Church. Is that true?
No. He loved the LDS people, and as a matter of fact, so many people mailed him books of Mormon and doctrines. He kept the local missionaries covered, but he did not become an LDS member. He passed away in 2008.
So I was curious, were you the one involved in Brigham City? What other movies have you done? And as I understand, this was primarily driven by the Covenant Recordings and the professor, or was it your idea? You'd read the book and you decided to do a movie, or kind of curious how that came about, whether you were, and has this made a, were you exposed to near-death experiences before?
Yes. I wasn't involved in Brigham City, the film Brigham City, but...
Because there's another Brandon
is
Smith
there?
That was involved.
I think there's one down in BYU. Yeah. But how I became involved, my father is Paul Smith. He's sitting right here. He's the one in the film that talks about the two girls in his ward. He was on the Ions board a number of years ago. And so I'd heard random stories growing up here and there, and had always kind of had a little bit of an interest, and then expressed that to him, and he gave me a stack of books, all the classics, and just from there, I said, this is really interesting, and I'd like to put something together. And so we approached, him and I approached Covenant Communications at that time, and I'd already done 4 or 5 documentaries for Covenant, and so we already had a working relationship where we could explore the idea further. It was a really, really small budget, and that's actually one of the reasons why I almost didn't do it, because any of the stories that you read or hear, they say, well, they can barely describe or put into words the way that their experience happened, and so, like, how am I supposed to be able to recreate that? And I couldn't, and so I decided, instead of trying to visually show what actually happened to them, is like when you're reading a book, you have to just kind of imagine it. Just take the spirit of what the near-death studies can do and kind of went that route instead, just because of the small budget. But I hope that it still had that feel and that mission. So thank you.